I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome back to my show, which is now not only on 93.9 FM, but also on AM 820 during the recess of the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Samuel A. Alito. We will go back to them on AM 820 when they resume. In 1934, one of the most famous men in America wasn't a politician or a movie star. It was Melvin Purvis, the man credited with the capture of three public enemies, John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, and Pretty Boy Floyd. But the Bureau of Investigation's boss, J. Edgar Hoover, became so jealous of Purvis's growing fame that he vowed to destroy his reputation. With me now is Melvin Purvis's son, Alston Purvis, who has written a book about his father called The Vendetta, published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Purvis to my show today. Hello. Did your father's role in the capture of Dillinger make him a hero, do you think?
Yes, it did. At that time, the press made heroes out of the gangsters, and the public needed a hero for the other side. And my father, whether he wanted to or not, began to fill that role.
And what did he think of himself as?
He never thought of himself as a hero. He was simply doing his job. He tried to avoid the press, and yet my father had a certain aura about him which the press liked. You know, he would, unlike other agents, he loved the opera, he loved theater, he kept a Palomino mare, a stable next to Lincoln Park, which he'd ride on Sundays sometime, and he had this aura which the press liked.
How did he capture Dillinger? Actually, Dillinger died.
Yes, it was my father received a tip from a woman named Anna Sage.
The Lady in Red.
Yes, the Lady in Red. Actually, she was wearing orange, but it looked red in the streetlights. And then she called him on a Sunday afternoon and said that they were going to one of two theaters. And so my father had them both staked out. He was seen going to the Biograph, and they surrounded that theater, and they waited until he came out. My father went in to possibly arrest him inside, but it was too crowded, and people could have gotten killed. So he waited until he came out.
Had you been born by then?
No, I was born in 1943. In fact, I never saw my father till I was 3 years old, because he was overseas during the war.
Mm-hmm. And when did you become aware of what he had done?
I became aware of that fairly early, but I didn't. It was something that was sort of a way of life for us in our house, so it was not something that really impressed me that much as a little boy. It impressed my friends a lot,
mm-hmm.
but to me, that was just my father.
And did he talk about it much?
He would talk about it when pressed. My father, it was not something that he liked to talk about, but sometimes I would say, Daddy, please tell me more about this. And he said, all right, I will, but let's not do it for another month after that.
But not just Dillinger. He went after a number of public enemies.
Yes, the next one, the next major case was Pretty Boy Floyd. That was exactly 3 months after the shooting of Dillinger, and that was in a cornfield in Ohio. And then right after that was Babyface Nelson. My father's men got Babyface Nelson. My father was not on site then.
But he was in charge of these investigations.
Yes.
How old was he when this was happening?
He was 31, mm-hmm. which is amazing.
Very young to be put in charge of such big investigations.
Well, I was talking to Doris Lockerman. Her name was Doris Rogers, and she was my father's private secretary during that time. She's 96 now and lives in Atlanta and is a major part of my book. And she said that they were all so young then that my father was one of the oldest ones. And there were a few secretaries who were older, but they were, and she also said that sadly they all died very young. They were just burned out.
This is before it was called the FBI.
Right. It wasn't called the FBI until the spring of 1935. It was called the Bureau of Investigation.
But J. Edgar Hoover was in charge.
Yes, he was in charge of it. Yeah.
What kind of relationship did he have with Hoover as he was rising up the ranks?
They became friends at first. My father rose faster than any other agent. As one can see from their correspondence, it starts off, Dear Mr. Purvis, then Dear Melvin, Dear Mel. And then that changes around November of 1934. That goes back to Dear Mr. Purvis again.
And that's simply because you think your father was getting too much media attention?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, it was a very complex story, but there was no room in Hoover's FBI for any name to come up but his. And in December of 1934, there was a newspaper poll of the 10 most famous people in the world. And it was published in a lot of magazines. One was called the Literary Digest, which was had a wide circulation then. And the only American on the list who topped my father was Franklin Roosevelt. Hoover was not on the list. And when that magazine hit the office around Christmas, Doris Lockerman said, "Alston, all we could say was God help Melvin."
Well, Hoover got a lot of credit for breaking the cases as well, didn't he?
He did, and my father tried to give him credit as well. Before the Dillinger case happened, there's a memo I found where my father recommended to Hoover to have all news dispatches come only out of the Washington office, and that would eliminate this, you know, row of reporters we had in Chicago. But apparently that was not done.
And how did your father handle all the attention? Was the press hounding him for interviews and the like?
Yes, he could only give interviews when he was given permission from the Washington office. But Doris said that in front of his office there was a hallway, and chairs on both sides of the hallway always filled reporters. My father had to walk through that hallway to get to his office. He'd walk in with his hat pulled over his face and say, "No comment, Colonel," going to his office. And then when there was a news bulletin that he could give out, then he would give it to all of them, not just one.
So you say that when all of this happened, suddenly the letters came back as Dear Mr. Purvis. The letters started coming addressed to Dear Mr. Purvis instead of to Mel. Is that all that Hoover did, try to freeze him out?
Yes, well, it was that. Then it was strange that even when he was still saying Dear Melvin, you'd find the same day a very petty letter about some, the telephone's not working correctly or something. You arrived at your office 2 minutes late yesterday. And then the same day there'd be a letter, "Dear Melvin, how do you help?" It was a very unusual situation. And then, in the end, though, it was not only that. My father would be sent on these missions to interview agents in other parts of the country, prospective agents, somebody on a very lower capacity would do. And
was he picking up the hint?
Well, I would think so, because he resigned. But it was... my father always tried to see Hoover after he left. My father really couldn't believe that he was turned on the way he was. My mother certainly knew it.
Well, it is surprising because in the end, Hoover, as the head of the agency, gets credit for good work done by the people who work for him. And whether they become famous for the moment or not, it all reflects on Hoover. This gives a sense that he was even pettier than we've heard in the past. It seems almost impossible that he might be this petty. Did your father still consider him a friend until it was no longer possible?
I never heard my father ever criticize Hoover to me, except one time. And that was when his friend, the very famous attorney named Bartley Crum, who defended the Hollywood Ten, Hoover pursued Bart, too. And Bart died in December of 1959, a few months before my father committed suicide. And my father was walking through the house that night when he got the news saying, "Damn Hoover for this," you know. And that's the only time I ever heard him connected.
My guest is Alston Purvis, who's written a book called The Vendetta with the help of Alex Trzeniowski about his father, the FBI hero Melvin Purvis, and his war against crime and J. Edgar Hoover's war against him. It is published by Public Affairs. Now, it's one thing to freeze him out. It's another thing to change the history of the FBI. You say that Hoover actually altered the records.
Oh, he did. Hoover tried to erase my father's name from history. There's a book published in 1956 called The FBI Story by a man named Don Whitehead. And my father is not even mentioned in the book, even though at that time he was certainly the most famous agent in the history of the FBI. And then after my father left the FBI, Hoover tried to change the records, say that someone else was in charge when my father was in charge, and things like that.
Well, how did you find material to include in the book?
Well, I found it through, you know, just normal research. Almost in a perverse way, Hoover did most of the research for me, because a normal file on the ex-agent might be a few hundred pages. The files of my father filled about 10 wine boxes.
Was he being investigated?
He kept a record of my father's every movement after he left the FBI, as well as when he was there. In fact, he even kept a record of my father's memory after my father died.
So your father was famous. I would assume after he left the FBI that somebody would have given him a prominent job.
Well, a lot of jobs, especially in Hollywood, did not go through, because Hoover would through his agent in charge in Los Angeles, say, if you cooperate with Melvin Purvis, we aren't going to cooperate with you anymore.
And, really? That nasty?
Yeah, I mean, and then in my book, everything I've said in it, I can back up. I mean, this is not speculation on my part. And then my father was nominated twice for federal judgeships, which any lawyer wants, of course. This did not come about because of Hoover.
And do you think that's the reason he committed suicide? That he was driven to suicide by Hoover?
I don't. Well, first, I'm not convinced my father committed suicide.
But the official record has it.
Well, it's. I think it was accidental. And I explained that in the book, my reasons for that. But even if it was suicide, and I think it takes a lot of courage to commit suicide myself, my father had been very ill at the time, and I don't think that his suicide was a direct result of Hoover. Yet my father's estimate of himself was not as strong as it was because of Hoover.
Do we know whether Hoover had any reaction to your father's death?
Yes. It was a very cold reaction. He announced just a few hours after my father's death to the press that Melvin Purvis had committed suicide, even without an inquest. There was no letter of condolence to the family, to my mother. She was a widow then with three sons. And then my mother sent him a telegram saying I forgot the exact wording of it now, but that but then Hoover wrote on the edge of the telegram saying, don't reply to this, she'll probably distort this too. Pretty cold.
Mm. Well, you had to do a lot of research. Did you discover things that you didn't know about your own family history?
Yes, I did. Not so much about my family history, but about my father's career. And, of course, you know, the deeper I got into this, the madder I got. And I had a friend in Boston who served as one of my editors named Jim Story. And Jim would say, "Whoa, Austin, calm down." And I didn't want this book to appear to be just a memoir of a bitter son. I wanted to tell the true story.
Well, you'd written before, but the other work had to do with graphic design. You are the head of the graphic design department in Boston's University College of Fine Arts, aren't you?
Right.
And had you always wanted to write this book?
I had. It was a book that I had thought about years ago. In fact, the first person I talked to about this was Walker Evans, a photographer. Walker was my teacher and friend when I was at Yale.
That must have been exciting.
In fact, Walker and I were going to do a documentary on it one time, but then I went to Europe, and then Walker died in 1975. But it had been on my mind for a long time. Yet I didn't really start seriously working on it until around 7 years ago.
Had you ever considered doing something other than going into graphic design? Your father was a famous lawman.
No. When I was a little boy, I told my father once I wanted to be in the FBI, too, and he said, "That's the silliest thing you've ever said in your life." He said, "You have a talent I don't have, and go use it."
Well, we've talked about Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Babyface Nelson. Were there others?
Oh, yes. There was Doc Barker. In fact, my father personally wrestled Doc Barker to the ground, and that must have been something, because my father was a very small man. And then there was Baldy Davis. A lot of these names are not really part of history. You know, the Barker gang is,
mm-hmm.
but the others were not.
And that was Bonnie and Clyde, wasn't it?
Well, no, Bonnie and Clyde was not part of my father's job.
I always thought the Barkers were related and connected to them in some way.
No, they were. That was Ma Barker and her sons, and then there was Vern Sankey, and there were a number of others. But it was, must have been, they were all well known at that time.
Well, this sounds like something that should be made into a film. Has anybody asked you about that?
Yes, they have, and I can't go into it, but it has been optioned.
And the book is called The Vendetta, FBI Hero Melvin Purvis's War Against Crime and J. Edgar Hoover's War Against Him, written by Alston Purvis, the son of Melvin Purvis. And with the help of Alex Trzeniowski, it is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Up next, Lee Eisenberg, former editor-in-chief of Esquire, on why we need to get over our financial anxiety about preparing for retirement and start planning now for a comfortable future. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820 and WNYC.org, the place for news and talk all day, classical music all night.